Milí příznivci akutních střet, vítám vás na našem dalším webináři. Kdyby byl rok 2021 standardním, byla by zřejmě většina z nás na cestě do sněhem zaváté Ostravy, aby se zúčastnila naší největší vícedenní akce, kongresu již s bezmála 23 letou tradicí, festivalu Colors of Sepsis. Bohužel kvůli epidemii se však organizátoři této akce rozhodli najít nový dubnový termín a nás poněkud nostalgicky napadlo, že by se právě sepse mohla stát tématem našeho dnešního webináře. Navíc kromě tématu, který je tak neodmyslitelně spjatý s touto akcí, k nám dnes přijal pozvání i zakladatel a hlavní organizátor kongresu, pan doktor Roman Kula z fakultní nemocnice v Ostravě, aby nám představil, na co se můžeme v dubnu na Karlsech těšit a jaká bude letošní organizace kongresu. Ještě předtím, než Romanovi předám slovo, bych vás chtěl poprosit, abyste si stlumili vaše mikrofony a webkamery. Romane, prosím, máš slovo.
Děkuji, Romane, za úvod. Je to takové, že to mě, když mluví můj syn. A já zdravím všechny příznivce akutních střed a samozřejmě všechny příznivce Colors of Sepsis v Ostravě. A přesně, Romane, tak jak jsi říkal, jsem si na to vzpomněl, že loni o takovém čase jsme se právě chystali na večírek do garáže. Nicméně já určitě věřím, že to ještě nespočetkrát zažijeme. My jsme měli včera právě zkoušku organizačního výboru, aby jsme to naplánovali, jak to na ten letošek bude vypadat. A můžu vám říct tedy, že sepse určitě letos bude, a bude v posledním týdnu, v dubnu, s tím, že samozřejmě my ji organizujeme jako, nebo začínáme organizovat jako online verzi. Je to naplánované na 3 odpoledne, úterý, středa a čtvrtek, s tím, že budou 2 paralelní treky, jeden pro, v jednom treku budou přednášky věnované problematice mladých intenzivistů, problematice pediatrie a sesterské problematice a v druhém treku bude běžet, jak tomu já říkám, program Dospělé sepse. V každém případě jsme ale připraveni, jakmile to situace dovolí v počtu, řekněme 300, 400, 500 lidí, protože jisté možnosti Clarion pro izolované odizolování prostě účastníků umožňuje, tak bychom určitě zorganizovali prezenční formu s tím, že zdůrazňuji dopředu, protože se potřebujeme všichni setkat a vidět, že kromě odborného programu to bude mít silný sociální podtext. Takže to je z mé strany asi všechno, držte nám palce, my jsme prostě nabuzení, nadšení, chceme to udělat a chceme v tom samozřejmě pokračovat, takže děkuji a zdravím všechny.
Romane, já ti moc děkuji za tvoji zdravici, za cenné informace k Colorsům. A budu teda doufat, že se uvidíme v tom dubnu, v tom posledním dubnovém týdnu, pokud možno v Ostravě i fyzicky. Nejen přes obrazovky našich počítačů. A nyní již nastal čas přesunout se k našemu dnešnímu webináři, který se dnes výjimečně uskuteční v jazyce anglickém. Organizace však zůstává stejná. Jak jsem říkal na začátku, mějte prosím vypnuté vaše mikrofony i webkamery. Své dotazy k přednášce můžete kdykoliv psát do chatu, jehož ikonku najdete v pravém horním rohu. Celý webinář bude nahrávaný a jeho záznam naleznete v řádu několika hodin po jeho skončení na stránkách www.akutnie.cz. And now it's a time and it's my great pleasure to introduce you our very distinguished guest, internationally recognized capacity in the field of intensive care, Professor Joel Molnar. Will throw some light on his personal view on sepsis. I would like to also add that Professor Joel Molnar is very tightly connected to the Colors of Sepsis As our distinguished guest, he pronounced many lectures focused on sepsis and cytosorb and biomarkers. And I believe that we'll be able to meet in person shortly in Ostrava with Professor Zsolt Molnár. So the desk and the virtual space is yours, Zsolt.
Thank you, Roman, and the warmest regards from my side to all of you. And I am going to share my screen. Yep. And please let me know if there are any problems.
Yeah, everything is going quite right.
Yeah, so I didn't remember for the title very well. So I put it the way that sepsis is the way I see it. And before we jump on this very special subject, yes, I mean, I have been regularly invited to Ostrava and to other meetings. And over the 1.5 years, I have changed track in my career in a way that I resigned from the University of Szeged last year in June for numerous reasons. And I decided to join Cytosorbents as a medical director. Now I am a senior medical director, but I am also keeping my academic affiliation. I have a very, very close day-by-day relationship with the Translational Medicine Institute at the University of Pécs. It is a fantastic adventure. A lot of studies and research is going on that I am helping with. I'm also a part-time professor at the Department of Anesthesiology and Intensive Therapy in Poznan. And I help out now and then as a senior intensive care tutor at a large district general hospital in Hungary. So it is a very colorful life that I'm living, and I'm very happy with it. And before we jump on the topic of sepsis, let me just give you a brief overview how I see my relationship with you, with the Czech society. And it was somewhere around 8-9 years when we first met with Roman Kula. And ever since then, I was a regular invited speaker to his meetings, which I am really grateful for. And I took a few pictures because the colors of sepsis was a major event of the year. At this time of the year in January, traveling by car, that was awful, but traveling by train, that was very good. And this is a lovely picture. This is a lovely picture I wanted to share with you. Possibly you have already seen it. It's the two Roman Kulas, the junior and the senior. And Roman Junior is interviewing his dad on one of the Colors of Sepsis meeting. Possibly it was the last one in 2020, I don't know. But this is a lovely, lovely picture. And the other person I have to make a comment on is Jan Beneš, good friend of mine, because he has been the founder of the Seps East movement that we initiated, together with Roman Kula, by the way, in Eastern Europe, Central and Eastern Europe. And I will tell you a bit more about this and how we support each other. Nothing describes it more than this kind of snapshot of the program from a few years ago, when we've been endorsing each other, Colors of Sepsis and Sepsis and all the others. So we try to make life better in Eastern Europe. So that's it as an introduction. What am I doing in an event that is a Czech webinar? And I do congratulate you for continuing this. We started this in April here in Hungary on a bi-weekly event, but I learned that you've been doing that ever since on a weekly basis. So congratulations to all the organizers. So now let's start with sepsis. This is an old slide, And I will tell you more about the title of the slide a few minutes later. But this is an old paper of ours. This is my good friend, Ewan Shearer. We worked together in Liverpool on an ICU. And this is a paper which is irrelevant, to be honest. It's not an important paper published in British Journal of Intensive Care Medicine several years ago. But in this paper, we published this figure. And this figure just describes what we observed at the patient's bedside. And what we saw was that regardless whether the patients were admitted with sepsis or infection, after road traffic accident, acute pancreatitis, major surgery, burns, whatever, these patients more or less followed the same track, the same clinical features, the same biochemical features. So how we translated this was that these insults can provoke a host response, which is very complicated. At that time, we knew very little. We knew about white cells released, cytokines, physiological reaction, and so forth. But we recognized that this kind of local insult resulted in a systemic response, which eventually led to multiple system organ failure. And the paper was on how we could possibly improve the outcome of multiple system organ failure. But we recognize that there is an insult, the body responds, and there is a severe evolvement of events and a serious condition that can develop. And this was the time when I wanted to kind of translate this to the public on conferences and wherever, where I developed this concept of sepsis and love. So this is the title of the slide as well. And I realized that there is a lot of things in common with sepsis and love. If you think about love, love is a systemic response to an insult, which is provoked by somebody, obviously. And if you think about it, there's a lot of analogies between sepsis and love. Just think about it. When you're in love, then your heart rate goes up, your heart is racing, then you are tachypneic, you have organ dysfunction, like altered mental status, you know, and it can be lethal, like a broken heart, and never mind death. So it's a kind of a more or less a funny relationship, but to put the joke aside, it has an important message for us doctors, because from this sepsis and love thing, you can understand that you meet a lot of people in your life, but not everybody has the same effect on you, why they have a similar effect on the others, and you don't provoke the same response for the others. Why is it important for us doctors? And this is especially important for my surgeons. I keep telling them that, listen, you are the best surgeon in the world. You do the same operation on every patient, and fortunately, most of them will come away from it with a good response, with a good outcome. But some patients will go bad, inevitably, because it is not really your perfect technique, but the response that the patient is giving to this that will just determine the post-operative outcome. And the same holds true for us intensivists and anesthesiologists. You give a drug and you cannot predict the effect 100%. It is an individual response. So to cut the long story short, the key isn't the insult per se, but the host response. And that was something we described in 1998 with my good friend Ewan Shearer. Unfortunately, later on I discovered that Sir William Osler in 1904 already discovered this in his patients, and he published this, that except on a few occasions, the patients seem to die from the body's response to infection rather than from it. Now, there's nothing new under the sun, and a few decades later, and this is János Scheie, or Hans Scheie. He was born in Hungary, but then he did his university studies in Prague. so some Hungarian-Czech relationship, and then he moved. He went all over the world. He spoke I don't know how many languages, and then he settled in Montreal, Canada, and he published this paper in the Nature in 1936. And this has pivotal importance for us. What he did to his little mice, that he exposed the mice to acute non-specific insults. And what he discovered was that a typical syndrome appeared, which was independent of the nature of the damaging agent, whether it was a surgical injury, cold, spinal shock, whatever. And it was rather a response to the damage. And now, and that was, by the way, the discovery of stress. And in brackets, he was nominated for Nobel Prize for 16 or 17 times and never got the Nobel Prize. But nevertheless, we have been following in his footsteps. And now this concept, this philosophy of Sir William Osler and Janos Scheyer, Hans Scheyer, gives an explanation to what we see in critical ill patients. Now, fundamentally, there are two types of insults. Physical damage to the cells. This is like a surgery, physical trauma, when the cellular structure is damaged by an injury. And pathogen associated injury. And the striking discovery was, and we call the molecular response damage-associated molecular patterns and pathogen-associated molecular patterns. And the striking discovery was that regardless really of the insults, the players are more or less the same. The same molecules are released in a variable fashion. So let's go away now from the bedside, because in our everyday life, you and me in front of the camera or the screen, we do suffer PAMs and DAMs daily. And if you look at these two kind of physical injuries, this is a boxer, this is a post-operative situation after a knee replacement. Now, if you imagine the face of the boxer and the knee, they both will be swollen, red, hot, painful. In other words, showing the local signs of infection or inflammation as described by Celsus hundreds of years ago, rubor, dolor, calor, tumor. But they will, the boxer and the woman will go back to normal life after a few days, no problems. And we do suffer pathogen-associated insults like local infections and systemic infections like a flu, very actual these days. And we do have local signs of inflammation, systemic signs of inflammation, fever, aches and pains everywhere, but we do recover because these responses, the swelling, the signs of local, it is a normal response. So this inflammatory response is essential to conquer the injuries. In the case of physical damage, we have to get rid of the dead tissue. Like after war, the dead bodies must be cleared from the battlefield, otherwise plague is coming. And in the case of pathogen-associated insults, we have to get rid of the pathogen and also the damage that it has caused. So it is a vital response. It is a key to life during injuries and any type of insults. But it is only good if we are healthy, and this is a healthy response. So what does it mean, healthy? For this purpose, I thought about it long, and now it is published in a paper. And it is all about the balance between the antagonistic forces in our body, which is depicted by this yin-yang symbol. So nobody else understands it better than we critical care physicians, that for us to function physiologically normally, there must be a balance in our homeostasis. And the balance is between two antagonistic forces, acid and base. The same holds true for hemostasis, pro and anticoagulation, a dynamic balance which protects you from bleeding away, if you bleeding to death, if you cut your finger and it stops the bleeding, but it also prevents you from developing thrombosis now when you are sitting in front of the screen. A very dynamic balance. If it goes out of order, any of those two, you end up on a critical care unit. The same is true for oxidants. I mean, these days, pharmaceuticals sell antioxidants like remedy of eternal life. This is stupid, absolutely stupid. Don't spend any money on this. Just buy Hungarian red wine. This is the best antioxidant I can offer with a true conscience, okay? But by and large, this is a very fine-tuned balance, just like acid and base and pro and anticoagulation. What we are focusing on now, and this is one of my major research interests as well, is a balance between pro and anti-inflammation in the context of sepsis. So this is my very good friend, Didier Payen. And this is a figure I borrowed from this paper. Please read it, very good paper. And on this figure, you see the two fundamental components of our immune system. One is the innate immune system, the one we were born with, and the other one is the acquired, the adaptive immune system. Now, let's call, for the sake of simplicity, the innate component, the pro-inflammation, and the adaptive anti-inflammation. So these are two antagonistic forces. And as you can see here, when we are healthy and we just function during our everyday life, these two forces act in balance on a baseline level, low activity, okay? Skin protects us from the environment. And whenever you inhale something or whenever you take food in, whatever, the immune system protects you from the undesired substances. Now, when we are ill, let it be flu, damage, whatever, then our immune system, as you can see it on this graph, changes activity. But as you can see here, both the pro, the innate, and the adaptive, the anti-inflammation, increases its activity in a parallel fashion. And if we are healthy, and this is the time when you feel awful, you have aches and pains, and you think you're gonna die, but then your immune system will recover the situation, and after 7 to 10 days, you will recover without any medical help. This is the normal immune response. And the problem in the critically ill, that this nicely controlled balance goes out of hand, and pro-inflammation during the early phases overwhelm anti-inflammation. And these patients can die due to fulminant septic shock at the beginning of the course of their illness, or due to fulminant hyperinflammatory shock, let's call it this way. This is why the systemic inflammatory response syndrome was a wrong concept, and it resulted in several trials which ended up with useless results, because systemic inflammatory response, when you have fever, aches and pains, it is a normal thing. It's got to happen. But the emphasis must be put on the dysregulated host response. I will get back to this in a minute. Now, fortunately, we are very good on the intensive care and critical care units, so we can save several patients during the early phase. However, when the insult goes on, they develop immunosuppression or immunoparalysis, and these patients are prone to secondary infections, they are immunosuppressed. So this is why we have to pay special attention for them. However, I have no time to dig deep into this subject. Nevertheless, going back to the first scenario, the hyperinflammatory response, it is now well recognized, and sepsis 3 defines sepsis now as an organ dysfunction, a life-threatening organ dysfunction due to a dysregulated host response to infection. And the first author of Mervyn Singer can be seen here. Now, several years gone by since sepsis 3 was published, and this is a very recent paper I published with Jan Bakker, who you can see, and he is the editor-in-chief of the Journal of Critical Care. And we feel that this new way of seeing this problem of inflammation, sepsis, whatever you call it, resulted in a paradigm shift. And what is it? We have new terminologies now. You more often see dysregulated immune response as a definition of sepsis, cytokine storm, hyperinflammation, and these are all more or less to replace SIRS, okay? And you can listen to Jean-Louis Vincent, who will tell you that SIRS was a disaster. Now, anyway, another term has also come and will come into our vocabulary. It's vasoplegic shock to replace septic shock. Because if you think about a patient with acute pancreatitis, patient after severe trauma, they show exactly the same signals as patients with septic shock, although there is no bacteria or pathogen whatsoever. And these are, so it is much better to call this a hyperinflammatory vasoplegic shock rather than call them septic shock, because you cannot use septic shock in pancreatitis. So this is how we see it. In this paper, you can see this figure. There's an injury which can cause critical illness, which will not respond to basic resuscitation. And several patients will recover. Some will go into hyperinflammation. Some will develop fulminant shock. Some will stabilize. And in the gray zone, you may try something else. I will get back to this in a moment. However, if you read recent papers, this hyperinflammation and controlling inflammation is becoming more and more an issue. And in this paper, and I don't have time to go into the details, but this was a retrospective study. And forget the results. It was a positive result supporting cytokine removal, so attenuating cytokine response. But what they say is that septic shock originates from severe host response derailment, and endotoxin, and such as these patients may benefit more from cytokine removal therapy, than antibiotics alone. So there is a change of paradigm indeed. And we are now in the COVID-19 era. So let me just quote one paper in this regard and quote their conclusion that controlling the inflammatory response may be as important as targeting the virus. Now, I think this is a kind of a paradigm shift. Obviously, we could talk about it for hours. But let's go back to sepsis, because this is our main topic for today. What about mortality? Now, I started with sepsis and love, so let me take you back to love, which has been extensively researched. And this is one of the first and most popular papers of this topic. This is the Romeo and Juliet. And if you read this wonderful drama, then you will find that mortality was 100%. So love is a serious inflammatory response, which can result in high mortality. Now, when we look at sepsis mortality, this is an Australian and New Zealand network study, an observation of 12 years for 2000 to 2012. And 1 million patients were treated on the ICU in this region of the world. And you can see a fantastic decline in mortality, more than 15% reduction. Amazing achievement over the few years. But let's take a break and just look at the numbers. Well, if you look at the number of patients entered into this registry, in 2000, only 2,700 patients were regarded as patients with sepsis. In 2012, 12,000 patients. Now, this is a more than fourfold increase, okay? So this reduction in mortality, is it not due just to the dilution effect that we call patients septic because the definition has changed? And in fact, if you see the number of patients dying, the populations did not change. Sepsis is not an epidemic like COVID-19, but there were 950 deaths in 2000, and in 2012, 205,000. So 2.5 times more patients are dying in Australia and New Zealand because of sepsis as 12 years ago. Is that correct, or is something wrong here? There is something must be wrong here, because when you look at the large American and Australian studies, the hospital mortality is around 20%. Fantastic. And when you look at European studies, and this is a courtesy of my friend, Professor Brunkhorst, then the mortality doubles or even it even goes higher. And when you look at the first interim analysis of the CytoSorb registry, and CytoSorb is usually used in this is a cytokine removal therapy in patients with septic shock, the most severely ill, then you find that the actual mortality, the predicted was 85%, and the actual was 65%. So a lot more patients are dying in Europe than in America. So the question comes, did we speak the same language? And do we speak the same language? Well, hopefully sepsis 3 will help us. Well, so now we have a definition, a new definition. And this is a question whenever I do my ward round in an ICU, my junior doctors, my colleagues from surgery, medicine, they ask me, is this patient septic or not? And I think it's a totally irrelevant question. I'm not interested in this because the patients would not benefit from answering this question. And let me tell you that I have never treated sepsis in my entire life. And if you read the recent paper from Jean-Louis Vincent and Arthur Slutsky, that you never seen ARDS in your life. This is the title, Intensive Care Medicine, Strong Recommendation. I've been saying that for 15 years, by the way. So I have never treated sepsis in my entire life, but I treated patients like this one here. This is a patient after severe road traffic accident, multiple trauma. And in this patient, we did discover respiratory dysfunction. Put the patient on ventilator, PEEP, whatever, lung recruitment, and we handled the situation. We discovered hemodynamic instability. We gave fluid, vasopressors, invasive hemodynamic monitoring, and got the situation under control. There was renal dysfunction, we put the patient on renal replacement therapy. Augmentation, we dealt with accordingly. We put an intracranial and a tissue oxygen measurement in and feeding and so on. What I'm getting at here, that you don't treat sepsis. There is no anti-sepsis medication. You treat organ dysfunction. There are objective signals that something is going wrong. Hypoxemia, blood pressure, cardiac output, whatever. And you treat infection. And this is the key issue, whether the patient who is critically ill has infection or not in this sepsis context. Because if there is infection, you give antimicrobials. If there is no infection, you shouldn't give antimicrobials. Now, how can we diagnose infection at the bedside? The clinical signs are obviously very important, but we all know that they are not good enough. Traditional markers like fever, leukocytosis, even in 1985, they were reported to have a 50% sensitivity. And a few years later, in 2016, with my PhD student, Trashido Monkoc, we published a paper, two papers, in fact, that these are not any better than to have a 50% sensitivity and specificity. Indeed, so these are poor indicators of infection. Microbiology is obviously the gold standard, but the results come late and there are several false positive and false negative results. So this is why we use biomarkers. And biomarkers are important. Unfortunately, they are called sepsis biomarkers, which is a false term because they should be called, just think about the PAMP and DAMP and the same response, inflammatory biomarkers. Undoubtedly, my favorite is procalcitonin because I have the most experience with this. And I will share with you some results with PCT. But what I learned over the last 20 years working with PCT, that using biomarkers is not easy. So this is one study I wanted to share with you. We published with Domo, with Domonkos. And these are patients in whom we had procalcitonin from the day before. And on the day when we suspected infection, we were evaluated the kinetics of procalcitonin in a post hoc manner. We defined patients in whom infection was proven. And there were 29 patients in whom infection was not proven. And we compared PCT kinetics in those two. And what we found, that patients in whom there was no infection, their PCT remained low. But patients who developed infection, indeed, then there was an increase in their PCT. And when we calculated the receiver operating characteristics curves, and we of course looked at CRP, white cell count, and temperature, the area on the curve, as you can see here, was 50%. It's not any better when you toss a coin. If it is head, the patient has infection. If it is tail, the patient doesn't have infection. However, PCT increase had a very good area and a curve of 85%. So if you measure PCT daily and there is a jump or you suspect infection, it may help you to define what to do. And if you decided to give antibiotics, and this was the main study of ours, including 200 patients, we looked at how procalcitonin changed in patients in whom the antibiotics were appropriate as compared to those in whom the empirical antibiotics were inappropriate. And you can see a significant difference in the kinetics. Those who received wrong antibiotics, PCT kept going up, plateaued, and then came down. But in patients within the first 24 hours, PCT reached its peak, and by 24, it was already coming down. And we, of course, calculated the area on the curve. And again, more than 70% increase in PCT or less had a very good 86% receiver area on the curve to determine whether or not the patient is on appropriate antibiotics. So this can give you a signal, a little bit of help, whether or not the patient is on the right track. So we recommend to use kinetics rather than absolute values. This is a large Dutch study, and 1,500 patients were randomized to receive PCT-guided versus standard care of treatment, and the antibiotics were stopped if PCT dropped as compared to the peak by 80%. And you can see that there was more than 2 days reduction in antibiotic usage, reduced mortality, reduced costs. There were more reinfection, but it did not affect outcome. So to sum this up, I think we should use biomarkers in critical care medicine and not just in sepsis. And the kinetics will give you an individual response of the patient, and forget about the absolute values, because every biomarkers will respond in an individual manner. So what is high for you may not be high for me, and so on. Nevertheless, it's true even in COVID-19, it's important to emphasize. Now, this is Philip Schütz, good friend of mine, and this is a paper they published May, more or less for the emergency physicians, and they used this cutoff values, but they also included the follow up. So they recommend to use the kinetics, and they used an 80% drop to stop or to continue or whatever I recommend you to read. So going back to treatment, now we know the definition, how to recognize that the patient may have infection, how to treat them. Well, this is again our philosophy. I published with my PhD students and colleagues from other institutes as well. And this is the pathophysiology I was telling you over the last few slides. And this is our treatment pyramid. And what it tells you is the following. You see a critically ill patient. Then you do your basic resuscitation. You give oxygen, fluid therapy, inotropic, catecholamine support, transfusion, whatever. Now, most patients, fortunately, will respond positively for this. But in some patients, you think this is not just, it's not enough on its own, because you suspect infection, you define the source, and you do your source control. Surgery, radiological drainage of sepsis, or antibiotics. And most patients will get better, unfortunately. But some patients will end up on the ICU, and these patients will need organ support, ventilation, hemodynamics, renal, and so on. And fortunately, again, majority will get better. However, there is a group of patients who don't want to die, but they don't want to improve either. And this is the patient population who may require some kind of adjuvant therapy. And there are several tested, from steroids, immunoglobulins, extracorporeal cytokine removal, vitamin C, whatever. But it is a very gray zone at the moment. We don't have much evidence. But regarding the cytokines, so let me just share with you a few slides just to put this thing into the picture. This is John Kellum, and in 2007, they published a huge cohort on patients with pneumonia developing sepsis. And what they found that when the higher the pro and anti-inflammatory cytokines were, the higher were the mortality. In fact, the hazard ratio increased significantly whenever they had higher pro and anti-inflammatory cytokines. So it follows simple logic that if high inflammatory cytokine level is accompanied with high mortality, then if we reduce it, we may reduce the hazard ratio in our patients. This is the rationale of blocking or reducing cytokines. Now, anti-cytokine therapy was tested for a long, long time, and there are several studies, and to be honest, it was a disaster. So if you see the guidelines, they basically just don't discuss this anymore, because every trial with an anti-cytokine therapy failed. Well, we'll see what will happen with the anti-IL-6 tocilizumab story, because now we have positive results from the REMAP-CAP study, but we'll see. Let's wait for the recovery, and we will make a recommendation later. So this was a race to search the magic bullet to find the right anti-cytokine thing, and I was also... enchanted by this mission, and we were searching for a magic antioxidant, and it was N-acetylcysteine, which we researched for a decade or so. And if you read the German sepsis guideline from 2010, this is our paper that was referred to, which quoted that there is no magic bullet, and you shouldn't use other therapeutic approaches in these patients. So global cytokine removal, and I do apologize for the cytosorbent figure, but what I am trying to tell you that yes, indeed, in hyperinflammatory, in dysregulated inflammatory conditions, then to regain balance, to remove excessive cytokines, may have a rationale, and not only in sepsis, but in any kind of hyperinflammatory conditions. And this is my very close connection to the topic. This was a proof of concept pilot study in which we randomized patients, refractory septic shock patients, to receive either cytokine removal therapy or standard therapy. And what we found was a significant reduction just after 124-hour treatment in vasopressor need and a significant reduction in procalcitonin. So this is a new study from Austria. A very nice study when they compared patients. It's a propensity score match study who developed a septic shock, and then they were treated with cytokine removal therapy or received standard therapy. And this is the evolution of the vasopressor need of patients in the control group. Those who received cytokine removal, they had a substantially higher vasopressor need on the start. And if I transpose this curve here, then you can see that during standard treatment, the vasopressors come down nice and steady. But if you use cytokine absorption, the removal of cytokines may result in a rapid resolution of shock. And they also found better survival in this group. And when you look at the lactate levels, even those who did not survive and received cytokine removal, their lactate level returned to normal. So shock reversal occurred. Why they died, this is a different ballgame. So finally, this is a very exciting topic. And I think in the field of research, this is a hot topic, sepsis and inflammation. And we are in the same kind of club here in Eastern Europe. And let me share with you some data on our research output. This is something I did a year ago when I looked at highly qualified journals or important journals in our specialty in anesthesiology and intensive care. Within that year, there were 2,800 papers published. And then I looked at the input of Eastern Europe. And all in all, it was nine, but three were letters. So there were only six originals contributed to this 2,800. So this is a very poor contribution. And the COVID was kind of a revolutionary opportunity for us to show our strength in Eastern Europe. Because COVID-19 started in 2020, early times of the year, early months of the year. And when you look at the publication output in the world, it is amazing. 91,000, that was a few weeks ago. It's not a very current one, possibly it's over 100,000 now. Scientific papers published on COVID-19 on PubMed. Now, it means 250 articles per day on average. This is unprecedented in scientific history. So this, and you know, we all started from the same punchline in America, UK, France, Czech Republic, Hungary, Romania, Russia. But what happened was, if you look at our scientific output, then it's more or less even population-wise. Czech Republic, 200, Hungary, 180, 200, Croatia, 800, Poland, but yeah, 50 million, 40 million, Romania, again, 20 million. So there's a population-based difference, but this is our research output. And when I looked at what was really homemade and not in collaboration with Western Europe, then it was less than 50%, to be honest. So the really homemade, made in Czech Republic, made in Hungary, it is still less than what is depicted here. When you look at the Western output, the small countries, which are similar in size to us, you see a substantially higher publications, all well over 1,000. So, and when you look at the big ones, it is a steady 3,500 papers published over the last year or even more. So there is at least a 10 times difference still after 30 years that the wall came down. And I think we should seriously think about it because, I mean, COVID-19 is not a critical care condition. It's not an infectious disease problem. It has neurological, pathological, surgical, all kinds of consequences. And we in Eastern Europe were unable to change our research strategy. So if you go on the homepage of famous international scientists, they all have a COVID-19 portfolio. Now we missed this opportunity, and this just shows the weakness. It is a system problem. We have to change this. And this is what I call a thorough paradigm shift that is needed. And this is what sepsis is all about, because we share the same history here in Eastern Europe. We have a lot of in common in the present, and we were aiming to help. And this group of friends, including Roman Kula, Jan Benes, and Roman Zahorec, because I, you know, Czechoslovakia, it is still emotional to us, you know. So, and of course, he's one of our good friends. So we published this, and we decided during the springtime, paper was published in June. We tried to make a difference. However, it never came through, but we don't give up. And we do hope that we're continuing this collaboration. We can change things in Central and Eastern Europe, and we can kind of make things better for mainly for our patients. But it is also to motivate our junior doctors. It is of utmost importance. And this is a quote that I've been saying on every SEPS East meeting, of which now Jan Benes is the president. But together we win, divided we fall. So I changed it to together we win, divided we're slow. So if we pull together, share experiences, help each other, giving us ideas, just like we had a discussion about this webinar thing, and then you in the Czech Republic maintain this momentum, and you are still doing it. So these are the events we have to build on, and hopefully we will make life better. And with this, I am grateful for your attention, and I'm happy to answer any question if there is any.
Zsolt, we thank you very much for your engaging lecture, and also for stressing the importance of international friendship and international collaboration. I'm very glad that you are the first international speaker who pronounced his lecture in this webinar, and hopefully you will not be the last one. Just one reminder, you can add your questions or comments to the chat room. You can find the icon of the chat room in the right corner. So please do not hesitate to ask anything around the sepsis or intensive care. Maybe I will start with the first question regarding the treatment of sepsis. Many septic patients develop a fever during the sepsis. Do you believe that fever should be treated aggressively, or do you have an opinion that fever can be somehow protective for the patient with sepsis?
Well, I think fever doesn't treat anything on its own. It is just a signal that there is something going on. There is a war going on in mm-hmm. in our body, in the patient's body. It is a signal that there is a war. And you and me, Roman, I'm sure we had fever before. And this is an awful condition. I don't like it. So I like to treat it, but mm-hmm. I don't like to treat it aggressively. But by and large, I reduce fever not to treat the patient, but to help him to feel better. So because this is just a side product of this war. You know, when you do sport, your muscles are burning, you're sweating. This is exactly whenever the immune system reacts, it consumes ATP molecules, it consumes oxygen, it produces heat, because it is an energy consuming process. And this is why it is strong and strongly recommended not to do any sport when you are ill. Don't go to sauna. Every Scandinavian people know that sauna is completely forbidden when you are ill, because you need your energy for your immune system. Reserve it for your immune system, because your immune system has to fight the war. And your immune system, fortunately, is extremely well armored, and it can tackle these problems. So this is my long answer for your short question.
Thank you very much. In the meantime, we've got one question. Could you please make a crude assessment how many cases of septic patient may need some adjuvant therapy?
Well, it is it's a difficult question, and I can only tell you my experience. So we roughly use adjuvant therapies like immunoglobulins, cytokine removal. These were the most frequently used ones, about once a month or once in 2 months. And this was a huge ICU, 36 beds, a huge volume ICU. And but to be honest, I cannot give you exact numbers, because I don't know the situation in the Czech Republic, but auditing our work is a very poor performance in Eastern Europe. So to correctly auditing, what I mean is that, you know, whenever I address a question like this, you give the exact numbers, and everything is recorded and distributed in an open fashion, just like in the UK. And if you follow the ICNARC data during the COVID-19, I mean, this is amazing, really. I mean, you see everything there, patient numbers, percentages, all kinds of treatments. And I think this is where we should head in every single Eastern European country, to have a central registry. But of course, we need the government's support for this, because it costs a lot of investment, both hardware and software and human resources. But we have to collect quality data. And this is what we call audit. And without an audit, we cannot really answer these questions appropriately.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you for your answer. The other question is, how often do you recommend to take blood cultures, like every day or when anything just start happening in the patients?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, this is, again, a very good question. And usually whenever we suspect infection, we take a blood culture, or we take specimen wherever we suspect infection. And then we decide whether or not to administer antimicrobials. But how frequently? Well, once you have taken and when you started your antimicrobials, then it doesn't really make sense for a few days to take another one. And even though when you take another one, this is again now affected by your antibiotic therapy. But by and large, let me just get out from this question and just make a comment on this antibiotic thing. I think, and fortunately, Mervyn Singer, first author of Sepsis 3, is perfectly in line with my way of thought, that antibiotics are abused, overused, and overrated in fighting critical illness. And to be honest, we doctors, from general practitioners, pediatric general practitioners, adult general, to intensive care physicians, we are using antibiotics very often unnecessarily. We are abusing, overusing them, and we are responsible for all the multi-resistant strains that now are causing huge problem in hospitals all over the planet.
So you do not agree with the mantra that every hour counts regarding the start of the antibiotic therapy?
I gave a lecture last year in Ostrava on this, and that was specifically asked from your father to give a lecture on antibiotics and sepsis, and exactly. I think it's a totally wrong concept. And obviously we don't have enough data to support not to give antibiotics, and it is very difficult to avoid antibiotics, but especially in the severe cases, I have no problem with this. If the patient is on vasopressors and, you know, really in dire straits, but several physicians think that treating sepsis is defining the bacteria and treat it with antibiotics. No, and now in Sepsis 3, if you read it, and I entirely agree with this, it's a host response, and it may not be related to the bacteria itself. It's related to the host response. And we have to really sit back, think, look at the full picture, and make our decisions very, very carefully whether or not to start antibiotics. And this is another lecture, and I have given several lectures on this in Ostrava over the last 10 years.
Yeah, I remember very well. Thank you for your answer. Well, let's stay with the antibiotic treatments and go back to procalcitonin. Joel, do we have any data if there is a correlation between procalcitonin clearance and bacterial clearance in septic patients?
No, but I don't think it is. I don't think it's a good question because you know, bacterial clearance means usually the amount of bacteria measured in the blood, and the bacteria don't like to travel. It's not like a modern European society that we and the whole world, we love to travel. Bacteria are conservative. They like to stay, sit nicely in a cushy tissue environment, and then they just feed themselves, and they don't like to travel and being washed away in blood. So it's difficult, I think, to define bacterial clearance. To me, it is the clinical picture that matters. So if you started an antibiotic therapy, the most important and positive signal, it's not even the biomarkers, it's the clinical picture. If the clinical picture is improving, I don't care of any microbiology, any procalcitonin, precepsin, CRP, I don't care. Because the main, most important thing is to see the patient coming off the ventilator, coming off vasopressors, maintaining homeostasis and so on.
Yeah, it seems perfectly logical to me as well that once you see the improving clinical pictures and you hit by antibiotics right, there will be a decrease in procalcitonin and it will correlate with a decrease in bacterial amount in the blood. It's quite logical and comprehensive. Well, there is no more questions in our chat room. Right now, maybe I would like to ask, it will probably be the final question, but you've been talking about dysregulated host response, which can kill our patients. Can we somehow influence this dysregulated host response, for example, by nutrition therapy, by a correct nutrition strategy in septic patients during the first 72 hours of acute illness?
Well, again, that's a good question. And immunotherapy, for example, glutamine has been on the agenda for long. And I think that the biggest problem with this issue is that studies were designed by asking the wrong questions. And they asked, and if you look at critical care studies, the question was always whether it improves survival or not. And I don't think this is the right question. So, and again, this would take us very long. And it is just really a thought-provoking comment on this that just think about. I give oxygen to my patients to improve the oxygen content of the blood. I don't give oxygen to save patients' lives because it is not a life-saving. It is to improve oxygen. I give vasopressor because I want the perfusion pressure to be increased. And you know, I could go on and on with this. So I give nutrition because feeding is kind of normal. I want to provide energy. But whether it improves the outcome, eventual outcome, survival, in such a complex picture, like the critical illness, when every single organ is basically affected, this is a wrong question. So whether I don't know, the question should possibly be addressed in the future in a different manner, whether nutrition and nutrition as such will improve this and that. I'm not an expert in this field, but I have been more or less collaborating with those who are experts in this, and this is a fascinating topic, but yeah, I mean, it's It's a long way to go.
Jolt, I thank you very much. I deeply thank you for your nice presentation and very rich discussion. Unfortunately, the time is over, 1 hour, and it was, I must say, it was very nice, 1 hour. Now I go and switch to Czech language. Dovolil bych si vás tímto pozvat na další akutní středu, která se uskuteční 10.2. Tentokrát bude naším hostem pan docent Škulec a přednese svoji přednášku, která se bude týkat jeho tradičního oboru, a to je ultrazvuk a využití ultrazvuku v urgentní medicíně. Prosím, sledujte náš Facebook, sledujte naši webovou stránku www.akutne.cz pro další informace a my se budeme těšit na viděnou za 2 týdny. That's all.
I would also like to thank you for the invitation and for all the support I have been receiving from you, from Roman, and from Jan and from all the others I know. So I wish you a very, very pleasant evening and a good coming out from this COVID epidemic. And hope to fully see you soon.
Thank you.